they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole we found.
Welcome to another edition of Down the Rabbit Hole Newscast, where our crew of Monday morning InfoSec quarterbacks discusses the important events affecting enterprise security and provides their unique analysis and perspective. And now, James Jardine, Michael Santarcangelo, and the White Rabbit, Rafael Los.
Okay, folks, welcome to another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. This is Raf. Michael and James are out this week, and they are where I wanted to be at InfoSec World, but, you know, I moved a house, so here I am in Atlanta. But the good news is I've got some local friends and somebody else taking the place of Michael and James for the day. So with me here in my office here, it's John Foster. How are you, John?
I'm doing great. Ni hao.
And John's going to bring the compliance perspective, and you'll see why that's hilarious in just a minute when we start talking about our news for the week. But on the line with us is Mr. Sean Toomer, perpetual favorite.
Howdy.
Like, uh-oh, he left.
I'm here. How are y'all doing today?
We are good. So we're going to talk through some very, very interesting topics, and I think that this is going to be one of those fun – this is actually the perfect episode to have you two on. We're going to start with, a new study from the Pew Center, a whaling scheme that's brought some charges. We're going to talk about Android for just a moment. An interesting warning from the UK and the US governments about nuclear facilities and airports, and then we're going to end with a data breach settlement that should surprise nobody. But first and foremost, hey, turns out that the Pew Center survey told us that Americans lack understanding of cybersecurity measures. Guys, this is my surprised face.
Yeah, I can see it right here with mine as well. And I actually took the survey. I shared it on my blog and took it myself. And I missed one.
Oh, Sean. I'm so disappointed. I probably would have too. I didn't know it existed, so I did not take it. But I don't know. Like, as I'm sitting here, so I was compiling these. They asked some interesting questions. Can you identify the more secure password from a pick list? You know, hey, is public Wi-Fi secure? Can you identify a phishing attack? You know, how do you get yourself? Is email encrypted? Is email safe? Is VPN a good idea? Kind of those types of questions.
But then we have this botnet definition, which, if you're not in the business, doesn't matter.
That's true. That's quite true. Hey, Sean, how'd you find the survey? One did you miss? Do you know?
I found it on Facebook.
Oh, and well, so, of course. That's where all good survey. That's where all things you should click on reside.
Well, so the first thing I did is I looked at it and said, well, you know, what's the link that this is leading to? Because it could very well be like a phishing, you know, attack here, trying to get people given all their information or God only knows what. And so I went in and looked and I saw that, I think it was Pew Research that had put it on and their website was legit, and went to it. And the one I missed, I think it was the one with HTTPS, because it said something about, I overthought it, because it said nothing about the channel or the pipeline being encrypted. It was something else. Yeah, and so I was like, oh, well, this, they're trying to trick you here, you know? And so you start overthinking it. And now if, you know, someone hadn't thought about it that much, they probably wouldn't have missed that one. But I'll tell you the one I did not miss, but I looked at the numbers, you know, when it shows you what people missed most often. And it was the one about multi-factor authentication.
71% got it wrong.
Yeah, but let me tell you, when I got to that question, I sat there and looked at it and looked at it and looked at it, because I thought I knew the right answer, but there were a couple of them that really could be considered a form of multi-factor authentication. So I would probably throw that one out. I think that one was too difficult.
Fair enough.
It wasn't identifying multi-factor authentication. It was much deeper than that one, and it had a propensity to overthink that one.
That's fair enough. John, what's your take on this? Because my lens of if I'm a CISO, I'm looking at this going, I wonder how my population of employees scored or would score.
Well, that's always interesting, especially when you look at the not sure column. That's the one that interests me the most, rather than the correct or incorrect, because 10, 15 years ago, whenever on USA Today they were talking about this new internet thing, no one would have been able to answer any of these things at all. It would all be in the not sure column. So, turning off the GPS and other items here, public Wi-Fi, not always being safe, etc. People are starting to get that. It's these newer topics, and with anything related to training and education, it's repetition and framing it to the workforce in terms that, they can digest. And some of these questions here are more for IT professionals or people that deal with these topics on a regular basis as opposed to, end users. But it's interesting that we suddenly go from 30% and then up into the high 40s, and then we have these two outliers here in the 70% of botnet is composed of computers used for criminal purposes, or a VPN minimizes the risk of using insecure Wi-Fi.
Right.
And, those two, 73% and 70% respectively, most average users would not know that sort of thing. But if you're in a corporate environment at Starbucks, you're probably going to be on a VPN.
Hopefully,
do these topics have relevance for your average business user? But one thing with training and awareness is, especially at small cap and micro cap size companies, is to phrase it in a way that they can take home. Phrase it in a way that helps them at home, and then hopefully they bring those same habits to work rather than doing it the other way around.
So we found that's been a big topic for discussion. I know people have found the most effective employee security awareness programs, and I'm not sure I like that the way that's titled, but that's what they're generally called, are the ones that make it relatable in the personal world, right? But don't necessarily start, doesn't center around the corporate environment 100%. So what's interesting is if you look at the this survey, hey Sean, in this link that I've got this posted to the show notes, the pewinternet.org research page. But so they did a cross section by your educational attainment, and then they did one by age group. So you'd think that perhaps, just perhaps, the younger crowd would know some of these because they're more tech savvy, and it turns out not so much, because the major differences, when it comes to can you identify a phishing attack? Pretty much everybody missed that.
Yeah, I want to echo what John said, because, in my experience, both in assisting companies through the breach response process, as well as trying very hard to get companies to be diligent and educate their people and start with some, basic training on this stuff, I have found that, we overestimate the level of education that so many people have on this stuff. I mean, I can't tell you how many clients I've had where, you talk to their workforce and they've gone through the check the box, fill in the blank training stuff. But it's just a series of questions in an abstract form that follow something they had been told an hour earlier, and so they're not learning to think about the situations in that real world, bring it home to me kind of sense. And that's the problem with all this, is whatever attack techniques are being used today, whether, it was the Nigerian prince, and then it was the FedEx, and then it's the latest scam to play on your sympathies. they're going to use something different tomorrow and next year and the next. So instead of saying, look for the Nigerian prince, right? You got to teach people how to think and understand the situation they try to put you in. And I'm telling you, it's always frightening when I see people that have made 100 on their compliance training, you know, some check the box thing, and can't guess or figure out the first one of these, especially phishing.
Yeah. Well, so to be fair, and I know the phishing, the one that they showed you was fairly obvious, right, to those of us that have done it a million times. But I'll tell you what, our corporate anti-phishing folks here have gotten some doozies lately that I actually have to go stare at for a bit and go to the, you know, headers and look at, okay, this doesn't look legit. Like, this looks too legit. Why am I getting this? But I know, but we know for a fact most users won't go to that level. So we talk about security having to be largely transparent to the user, but at the same time make them teach them just enough so they can think independently and make decisions. I tell you what, that particular game is getting harder and harder, especially when you've got folks that get good at using the appeal to authority, aka our next topic here, and this one. This is going to be interesting. They finally charged the suspect with, I believe he's a Romanian man, with a $100 million whaling scheme. So he made $100 million from exploiting just two companies, multinationals, two. In what's what was a, what they call it, a whaling campaign. I mean, speaking of phishing, holy cow.
Yeah, I mean, this one you really do have the shocked face going, right? And
counsel, please advise us on this.
I tell you, I talked to a couple of people about this last week, including some federal law enforcement officers, and they were kind of laughing about it. And they said, you know, look, if you're losing $100 million out of any company or any two companies, you have much bigger problems on your hand than just security. You know, how are you not catching this after the first? And this went on since 2013, from 2013 to 2015. At some point, how do you not have internal controls in place that are watching this and checking up on $100 million between two companies?
Is there a point here where that's actually just, you know, their multinationals aren't, you know, $100 million they lose in their couch cushions, but still, right?
Well, you know, the cyber is important, but there's other things other than the cyber here. Yes, I went there. you know, when we look at happenings like this from the finance department's perspective, you know, this is not phishing or hacking. This is payments fraud. You know, they pretend that IT has already been, you know, jumped over, and, you know, the controls within finance are the ones in place. And, you know, there are different dimensions, you know, to preventing this sort of thing. You know, first, you know, we might look at your anti-bribery, anti-corruption program. You know, this fraudster added a new payee into the system, which presumably would be a new legal entity.
Right.
So, you know, there should be some know your customer, know your vendor vetting.
Should be.
There. And in most cases, you know, that vetting is going to do a criminal background check on the CEO and the CFO of that company. May or may not have found something in this case, but normally nothing goes into your accounts payable system unless compliance has done that sort of vetting if you're in a know your customer environment. Within finance, you know, there were two different ways that this could have been prevented. You could have done positive pay, which you know, blocks any sort of payment from an unknown vendor. So if someone had just bypassed any compliance controls and said, oh, I'm going to put this new vendor in, not an authorized vendor, the payment would have been held up at the bank. You know, in the case of wire fraud, you never want to have one person in control of it. You know, you want to have at least two, maybe three people. And ideally, you have one person who initiates a wire request. And that's never the CEO or the CFO.
Right. Shouldn't be anyway.
Right. And then you have a person who queues it up in the system, and then finally a third person who verifies with party number one and number two to release the payment. And somewhere, if all these things were being done, it may have been prevented, but we don't know the size of all the companies involved, and many small businesses only have one person, you know, handling payables, receivables, and treasury.
Right.
So when you get into microcap size companies, it is a risk, and sometimes you have to involve more people in order to prevent this sort of thing. But it's an opportunity cost question at that point.
You know, that's a good point, and this is one of those areas where cybersecurity gets involved, but isn't, like, we're a stakeholder, right? We're part of the potential solution, but we're ultimately just a contributor. Hey, Sean, how often do you see stuff like this where they try to, you know, somebody tries to push the entire thing down onto cyber? And I'm sure, you know, liability insurance or cyber insurance would be the first place people would look and go, hey, wait a second, can we use our policy for this?
Well, I see it quite often, especially in the cases of the W-2 fraud, where they're impersonating someone in HR, or they're impersonating the executives and sending it to someone in HR, and they screw up and send the W-2s back. Then obviously it's anybody's fault other than HR, right?
Of course.
Because there's never their own, and so they're going to blame that on lack of, you know, cyber awareness and training and whatnot. And so it's fairly frequent, because that's the first thing people think about now is, a computer was used, an email was used, you know, so it's got to be a cyber issue. But you're right. I mean, you're just kind of an aside here. You're not the real core of the problem. It goes to what John was saying. You don't have controls in place to prevent this kind of activity through any threat vector. Yeah. But the point you raise about cyber insurance is critical. Because if there's one takeaway for people listening to this today, it's when you get your cyber insurance coverage, and you better, if not have it, you better have at least considered it. Then when you're getting that coverage, make sure you specifically ask and confirm that it covers social engineering. Because under many cyber insurance policies in general, social engineering is treated not as a loss under the policy, but as a voluntary act, because you were duped into acting, but you did it voluntarily. And so many policies will not provide coverage on that. So you have to make sure. Yeah.
Like,
yeah, voluntary action.
They may successfully or unsuccessfully try to claim it under general E&O, but insurance companies are becoming more wise to it. You know, they're saying it was a criminal act, not a negligence act, and they refuse to pay based on that.
Wow.
Yeah, and so now it's going to have to fall under your crime, you know, crime fraud type coverage, which, you know, may be the appropriate place. But if you haven't done your diligence in the beginning to make sure of that, you could be left holding the bag on that social engineering loss.
Well, so, I mean, if you read this on justice.gov, as you guys were talking, I'm just kind of skimming through it. False and deceptive representation over the course of the scheme. The gentleman whose name I will butcher, so I'll try not to pronounce, caused the victim company to transfer a total of over $100 million in U.S. currency from the victim company's banks to Company 2's bank account. So, I mean, basically, the way this reads is he had falsified contracts, he had signatures and invoices and fake companies set up. I mean, in some other countries, I imagine that that's not – some of these less financially developed, less formal, rigorous types of countries that don't have SOX, GLBA, and some of the other things that we worry about in place, you know, ALM, anti-money laundering – controls probably aren't in place in these major banks, and they're used to seeing large sums wired into and through. So this probably wouldn't have triggered anything. So at their side, right, at the banking side, man, I tell you what, I'd hate to be the person that has to go back to the boss and say, I think I just spent $50 million of the company's money and I don't know where it went.
Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, when you look at this scheme, I mean, this was not your typical run-of-the-mill doctor up an email phishing kind of campaign. Right. This was incredibly elaborate, well-planned, well-executed, because you set up a corporation, you know, in another country, and then you set up all these bank accounts, and you have a way to divert that money as soon as it hits your primary account into multiple other accounts. But you're talking about a ploy to steal $100 million as well, so it better be sophisticated. But, I mean, just think, man, like you said, imagine year-end bonus time, year-end review. How did I do this year, boss?
Well, you still have a job and we haven't prosecuted you yet, so you're doing great.
Yeah, exactly. And you're lucky.
Man, I tell you what, that kind of stuff, that's dangerous. And I don't – this kind of relates to the challenges we had in the cases we had with Swift, where it was more – you know, it was technical controls, but yeah, I mean, somebody hacked into a machine, but they initiated – wire and fund transfer that we keep saying somebody should have caught by looking at it. I mean, it increasingly more, you know, whether it's trading algorithms that continue to be more and more robotic, and we just saw that recently. If you guys watch CNBC, was it BlackRock that went to used to be, you know, all manual, and they moved to a mostly algorithmic with human analysis, they call it, type of platform. In other words, the robots do the trading. Because they're less emotional, they're more accurate, they're more predictable, usually, unless there's a bug in them, and we don't need to go there anymore. But this type of thing, as the financial system gets more electronic, takes the human element more and more out of it. Are we going to see more or less of this, do you think?
Well, probably more, unless we get better. I mean, look, at the end of the day, this is why you have controls, and John can speak to this better than anybody. You know, the people make mistakes, number one. Nobody's perfect, even no matter how well-trained they are. And number two, believe it or not, when there's money to be made, people commit crimes, you know, and will lie, especially on the internet. And so you have controls in place for this very reason, to catch and to keep that stuff from happening.
Yeah, so, you know, you bring up an interesting question, Raph, about, you know, is this going to become more common? The Association for Financial Professionals released, you know, an annual fraud survey, and check fraud is still 43% of the pie. You know, ACH debits are 10%, ACH credits are 5%, and wire transfers come in at around 23%. So checks are still the hot commodity. As a country, the U.S. still has not gotten off of processing checks, which, in order to prevent check fraud,
wow,
you know, positive pay payee is one of the biggest tools you can use, because people still wash the payee line off the check.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you have that enabled at your account, you know, with your bank, it's not something that you would have on an internal system. But, you know, the bank would say, you know, it doesn't match what we received in the batch from, you know, the payor. You know, there are other controls that you can use with ACH, but it's a war of attrition. And, you know, the thing that I've seen by going to a lot of financial conferences is still small businesses are not aware of all the features the banks have to offer to prevent these sorts of transactions from getting through. And it's a matter of turning them on. You know, I heard a story of where the cleaning crew brought in prepaid credit cards and then refunded the money out of the credit card machines after the business was closed. And the bank said, well, you can turn it on to where you can only refund the card that was used, but that's not on by default. So there are a lot of things that aren't IT department related that you can do from a business side that would prevent this sort of stuff, but it's an awareness issue. And you know, the smaller size company you go to, the less awareness there is. And then large companies, you have the complexity issue with bank accounts. You may have a single checking account that's only allowed to pay one vendor.
Yeah. Well, you've got, I can imagine the kinds of companies that can afford to lose, let's just say, you know, you did it twice, and that somebody can afford to lose $50 million. I say afford to, but without bankrupting the company. I mean, their financial system must be a bit busy. I'm sure they don't have one, given the fact that most companies have hundreds, if not thousands, and some entities several tens of thousands, third parties that they pay or on a regular basis or transfer funds in and out of. You know, a new one popping up, golly, I and you're right, you bring up a point, John. You know, the financial, Sean, when you've got crime isn't going to go away. I feel like, you know, we squeeze the balloon a little bit over here, and something else gets bigger. You know, we clamped down on, I can't believe check fraud, but okay, fine. Say we solve the whole check fraud thing, the criminals will move to somewhere else. I mean, it's just, that's what criminals do. Criminals gonna crim.
Yeah, human nature, man.
Oh, golly. Well, hey, speaking of human nature, it turns out Android security is getting better. Google released their annual 2016 year in review report, and there are some interesting things in here. It's a fairly extensive 71-page report. I skimmed most of it. The gist of it is a lot of focus on unwanted applications and malware in the Google Play Store, and you know, they've gotten better at it. There's less of the nasty stuff in the Google Play Store. The lesson I took away is two things. One, if you're installing something that requires you to turn off the feature that's only from known sources, you're asking for trouble. End of story. Full stop. Right. I get that in order for me to install stuff off the Amazon store, I have to go to the Amazon store, install the application, turn off the known sources, install the application, turn it off. And keep doing that every time I update. But I'm always good, and Amazon's actually fairly good at reminding you to turn it back, you know, put it back when you're done, because it's critical. But if you're installing an APK, you know, an install off of, you know, applications for free because they're hack.com, odds are, I think you're asking for trouble. But the Google Android operating system is getting better. There's the over-the-air updates are getting better. But guys, there are still, you know, this isn't Apple yet. There are still dozens of variations of Android out there, some very, very old, going back to 6 and 5 even. The prognosis doesn't look particularly swell for the future, because they were pretty excited about the fact that they reached, within a year, they reached 50% upgrade. Like, Apple does that in a week or less, right? Is that what do I remember that correctly? Hopefully. But anything to add?
Well, this is Apple's kind of a little heavy-handed too. I mean, you know,
that's true.
But for good reason.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've got that balance. Everybody kind of complains that Apple is so draconian in their policies, and they review everything, and they disapprove things for sometimes unknown reasons, and you have to do this and that. And, you know, there's been versions where now you don't really have a choice. My wife complains that her phone makes her update, and sometimes you just get, you know, reboots. In fact, you know, I had my Google Nexus. My phone would sometimes just reboot, and that's Google saying, "Hey, look, you're going to update this. We're not giving you a choice." But the point is, these devices are going into the hands of consumers. Consumers do not necessarily know or care about security. So hoping that they will maintain their device, whether it's their flat screen TV, whether it's their toaster, their mobile phone, Android in their display in their car, whatever it is.
Think about the nexus between this discussion of this topic and the one we just had.
Right.
It's putting controls in place that force people to do or not do things that you can't necessarily trust them to do on their own.
Did you just slip in a Yoda quote, "Do or do not, there is no try"?
If so, it was completely unknowingly, and I doubt I could repeat it.
That was well done, sir. But you're right. You know, when we look at that, the juxtaposition of that first topic we talked about with the Pew survey, and the fact that we're still largely asking end users, whether it's their laptop or their mobile device or whatever, these things are we are just starting to design for the auto updating of these devices. And I kind of wonder, you know, whether it's enough, whether it's too much in some cases, because you could disrupt somebody and then of course they're going to get angry with you because they're playing their favorite game and you force a reboot.
No, I was in Cancun a couple of years ago and had a project I had to have submitted by midnight.
Yeah.
And I had my time allocated the whole day so I could go out and do stuff with the family, get in, get back from dinner, take 2 hours, knock it out, and have it submitted. And lo and behold, I got the mandatory reboot your Windows, you know, updating with like 20-something updates. And it was
come
over
back tomorrow.
Wi-Fi. At a hotel in Cancun that kept cutting off. And I was about to lose my mind. I had to go down to the bar, not for a drink, but to sit there because that was the closest Wi-Fi I could get to get it to work.
Wow. You know, there's a real danger there. I mean, I know it's a little hyperbolic, but you're driving down the road in your Android connected car, not too far in the future, navigating in a city you don't know, and your device says, "By the way, it's time for update. We're gonna reboot you," and you're like, "Great, I'm on the interstate doing 65, and now I'm lost. I don't know where the hell to go. What am I gonna do? Pull over, wait for the reboot?"
Yeah, and then you get mugged and are rear-ended on the side of the road and injured, and you don't think somebody would bring that lawsuit?
Oh, absolutely. And then, of course, we're turning all the auto update features off. All right, so guys, we've got a little bit of brain power on this conversation. Where's the balance then? Because, you know, Apple, I'm starting to like this whole. I know, a couple of years ago we probably had this on the podcast. We were talking about is it time to? I know I like the Google approach with Chrome. They give you a warning. You know, your little bar turns green, then it turns yellow, and then it's like, you know what? We're going to reboot you. I gave you a day's notice. It's now time.
Yeah, I like that approach as well. You've got to have some kind of notice and opportunity to either get to a safe place, to get what you're doing completed. But at some point, I mean, it's not that we don't want to do the right thing and keep all of our updates current. It's that we're overwhelmed. Every one of us, and we're not the people running, you know, the networks. We're just here sitting at our workstation, our laptop.
Yeah.
And we still can't keep up with it. So you have to have some level at some point of saying enough's enough, do it. But you got to give people notice as well.
Well, that's the thing, right? Update fatigue is every device wants everything. Everything is now updating and rebooting, and sometimes you can do it without forcing the reboot, which is nice, but there's still a productivity lag. My wife had an interesting counter argument to this because we had an Apple TV that was, you know, an older unit that kept telling, "Hey, I need to update. Hey, I need to update." And she's like, "You know, the only time this thing ever tells me it needs to update is when I'm trying to watch something on it." I'm like, "Well, when else do you turn it on?"
Exactly.
Like, what do you do? Turn it on just to see whether it's got an update to it? No. But so can you imagine that? Like designing – I mean, look, if you're listening to the show, you're going, what are these guys rambling on about? Think about some of the software you're designing or devices you're deploying or your software to, and think about whether it's home smart automation. My new house has some of that. Cars, mobile devices, laptops, right? Computer, traditional computer systems. You know, industrial control systems, God forbid. How do you design for the fact that something is going to need a patch, an update, an upgrade with minimal disruption to these things?
Well, you know, Steve Jobs once said something like, if you want the latest thing, you got to buy a new one every year. So we need to rely on the marketing people to make at least Android phones fashion items just like the iPhone, and then people are going to buy one once every 6 months. So you've reduced your exposure window. I hate you.
I know plenty of people. I know plenty of people that already do that, and I may have somebody in my immediate family that does that. Sometimes works that way, but you know,
yeah, you know, for and I can say this safely because I don't believe my wife listens to this podcast. For some reason, every time there's a new iPhone coming out, she always starts having problems with hers. It's just the battery starts having bad life, or you know, it's not getting her messages right, and I'm like, I know where this is headed. Just go get it.
Coincidence.
You're like, gee, honey, your iPhone seems to be having problems. Oh, I see a new one's coming out. Would you like me to get you an upgrade? Is that total coincidence right there?
Exactly.
Oh man. Hey, speaking of weird coincidence, so there's this SC Magazine article that somebody tweeted, and I went up and looked at this. And so there's this I don't know if this article is just written like this on purpose or what, but it's basically saying airports and nuclear power plants in the UK and US are on high alert for cyber attack after governments in both countries issued alerts. It's like, wait, time out. Airports.
I know what it is.
What's that?
I can tell you the answer.
Please.
All right, after the election, the people writing political articles are now out of work, and so they're writing these.
Wait, hold on, Sean. Sean, have you seen the news? Nobody is out of work writing political nonsense. None of the shenanigans have stopped. In fact, now they're just more on more networks. But you're right. But so what's really weird is the nuclear facilities are under alert from an industrial control system style attack from all their legacy systems. And those of you that know me in person, I may have shared my nuclear facility bad thing I once did a long time ago in my career that I can attest to. Some of these places are probably vulnerable if you sneeze the wrong way, too close to one of these old machines. And when you look at some of the control rooms in these facilities, like in this article, they have an inset picture. They actually look like that, and yes, they will scare you. But so the threat there is cyber, but the threat to airports is bad guys hiding explosives in laptops and mobile devices. That's not so much a cyber attack, but just creative terrorism.
Yeah, that's like saying the shoe bomber was a Nike or a Converse or Adidas problem, you know? I mean, it's just a means of disguising your nefarious activities using whatever's the most convenient, you know, plausible way of doing it.
Well, I wonder, because I know several people that work in the industrial control sector, and they've been basically saying bad things are we've been telling people bad things are coming. We've seen bad things. There has been the industrial control sector, critical infrastructure, energy sector has been under assault and probably by more bad writing than anything lately. Yes, we all know, you know, attackers will attack, and they've been showing signs of that. But it's just some of this is just nonsensical writing by people who have no business writing in tech media. And what kind of scares me is the folks that read this, your average Jane and Joe, will read this and think that the world is coming to an end and they should move as far away from technology as possible, not really thinking about the fact that these, you know, these are low likelihood, high impact events, but there are people working on these problems, you know.
Yeah, around the clock.
Yeah, literally.
And that's the thing here. I mean, look. Both of these are legitimate concerns for issues that are newsworthy. Do they belong together in the same article? I don't think so. And I think, like you said, you know, how many people now get their news from Twitter and not from reading the articles, but from just scanning the stream and retweeting? And so all they see is the headline. Or the title of the article. And like you said, we're doing a disservice to security as a whole when we hype up the James Bondish sounding stuff at the expense of the reality, which is 80 or 90% of the data breaches each year and attacks are a result of failures of basic type stuff, you know, passwords, phishing, not the James Bond kind of stuff. And so we make people so helpless feeling because they're going, well, there's no way I could defend against the Russians doing this to me. So I'm just not going to try.
Well, I hear you, man. And I think I've said this to somebody recently. If you think if the Russian APT is part of your threat model, then you're an enterprise, not generally an individual that I will meet in my everyday life. But we like to plan for the exotic because it's cool, it's interesting, or we try to think about it. But you're feeling of like helplessness, and I can't defend against this. So why do I even try? Everything's broken. Ah, my TV's spying on me. Meanwhile, we're posting, you know, pictures of our new driver's licenses. Thank you, kids, on Facebook. So and still Twitter.
Exactly. That's why we've got to be careful. I mean, you know, we've got to make sure that raising awareness. I mean, you know, how many conferences do you go to now and still hear the old 2014 line of it's not a matter of if, but when? And there are only two kinds of companies, you know, and we love to hype up that real exotic cocktail party talk where everybody thinks we're real smart and cool because we get to deal with stuff like that.
I'm really smart and cool.
People do. What's that?
So I'm really smart and cool. Come on now.
Yeah, I know. But when you are, you don't have to try to make it sound that way. And that's the beauty
true.
Of your approach.
Hashtag trying too hard.
But you know, when we look at these sorts of events, and Sean, you're absolutely right that the media is scaring too many people. Let's look at this in terms of a game theory problem. What is the probability that your local nuclear reactor is going to explode due to maliciousness? You know, what's the probability it's going to explode as an accident? What's the probability a drunk driver or a shark in a taxi is going to eat you, okay?
Sharknado!
Exactly. So you know, when dealing with risk, you know, we have to look at what's the likelihood it's going to happen. There are tons of high-impact things that can happen, and, you know, if you want to read something fun, go to Wills Towers Watson and look at their extreme risks report from 2013. You know, like Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs said, you know, the definition of infinity is if you wait long enough, everything happens. Well, that goes back to it's not a matter of if you get hacked, but when. Well, you're going to get hacked every day or something like that. And when we look at nuclear cyber attacks or something, you know, that goes in the same category in this report along with biosphere collapse and alien invasion, you know. it's low probability, high impact, but do we see that in our everyday? You know, go back to Three Mile Island. When was the last time we had a meltdown due to miscommunication in the United States? You know, the last memorable nuclear event was Chernobyl,
yeah.
And you know, today it's a newsworthy item, but hey, the biosphere in that area has kind of come back. You know, animals are thriving without the humans there, so you know, things happen. We need to plan for realistic scenarios and not these edge cases. They're great for Tom Clancy novels.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like I like the fact that you brought up the quote because the one I'm always used to is that a long enough timeline, everybody's life expectation goes to zero. You know, so everything is possible at infinity, which is true. But I think out of this article, there's one quote here that just strikes me, because for those of you that are listening that work or conduct research or defend industrial controls networks, you'll appreciate this. And this is from a person that says, the configurations which are, quote, cumbersome and often manual don't naturally fit with the complexity of industrial installations that were never designed to be connected to the outside world. It's like Patrick Miller, gosh, I had him on my show ages and ages ago from Nesco Energy Sec, and he's like, look, we are connecting things within the energy grid that were designed 35, 40 years ago that where the internet wasn't even conceived yet, where telephones were still pretty cool, and you know the kind that actually connected to a wall and you stood there on with a really long cord and you talked. But we're connecting these things to IP networks, and we're wondering why they're causing potential harm here. It's like these things, you know, it's difficult to plan for a life cycle that is 30 or 40 or 50 years of a device when we can continue to retrofit it, especially when the review cycle or the refresh cycle involves the words shutting down the power grid. So, I mean, life gets more complicated when you have to turn off part of the country's power for, you know, a couple of days to upgrade everything. Oh.
Yeah, that's a serious risk issue. But, you know, when you think about the way that we're connected in that manner and people are, you know, connecting devices to it that may not have the security in and of themselves. I mean, I wonder if there are any of these around the country that have a webcam or some sort of a camera sitting there monitoring the control boards.
You know, you can assume the answer is yes.
You know, and were those the ones that we saw in the Den, you know, attack?
Yeah. Well, so, I who knows, man? It goes back to I think many of us need to understand what the word risk means and how to actually calculate things that are realistic versus the exotic. Yeah, sure, have that exotic case in the back of your head somewhere, but plan for those things that are happening twice a day, every day right now. And speaking of twice a day, every day, let's talk about data breaches because we'll end the podcast on this note. Neiman Marcus, the title of this article is awesome. Neiman Marcus data breach settlement tells us plenty about the ROI of security. When breaches cost so little, there's not much incentive to avoid them. And I'm going to pause there and let your brain settle down because some of you guys are like, you know, I know what you're thinking. You're angry, but just read this article. Think about this. The 2014 Neiman Marcus breach came down to a $1.6 million settlement. After attorney's fees and whatnot, the 370,385 people who were impacted, 9,200 of those shoppers experienced actual fraud as a result. And out of those, roughly out of that entire 1.6 million, you want to guess as to how much is actually going to the people that lost? 400 grand. Sean, this is why you do what you do, isn't it?
Yes, man, let me tell you. You know, I've read this article a couple of times, and I'm still just having a hard time comprehending let me just say two words, okay? Ford Pinto. Ford Pinto. Okay, the premise of this article is if consumer litigation is not successful against a company, then they have low costs for a breach and there's no incentive to improve their security. The consumer litigation has not done anything against hardly any of these companies that have had data breaches. And guess what? We're seeing raised awareness. We're seeing improved security. We're seeing them acting. The whole notion that one settlement in that one case, you know, predicts the ROI of security is just I can't accept that. And I say, you know, Target, Home Depot, they had some of the biggest settlements you've seen for consumer litigation, $10-11 million roughly. That's not much for any of these companies. The cost of a breach goes far beyond just the money you pay for your litigation cost. And the other thing is, you know, I say the Ford Pinto, and I don't say that lightly, because back in 2011, I wrote a blog post that's, as of right now, the most frequently shared or viewed post I've written. And that's when I said, data breach, who's going to get it? Because at that point, you started hearing people talk about this bean counter approach, this cost-benefit analysis of saying, well, it costs more to improve my security than it's going to cost if I get hit on this. Well, as of right now, nobody's had that catastrophic hit. But in Ford's time, back in the early 70s, nobody had that catastrophic hit against a company either, until a jury found that memorandum where they did that cost-benefit analysis and said it's easier to pay the victims of the families who get killed than it is to pay $4, $5, $6 or whatever to improve each one of these vehicles and make them safe. And when they got their hands on that, you know, they hit them with everything they could back in the day. And I think if a company ever goes through this process of a cost-benefit analysis like that, you know, we're not necessarily dealing with human lives unless we're talking about healthcare and situations like that, or transportation, or, you know, other areas.
Elevators, food prep.
Elevators. Yeah, I mean, let's keep going, right? But that's just nonsense. That's almost as senseless as the thing I keep hearing about people saying, if you have cyber insurance, you don't need to worry about your security. It's no, that's not the case.
So, Sean, I'm going to ask you this because this is I've heard the argument that it has been made that if the breach is, you know, the cost of the breach, you know, shareholder value isn't diminished enough. The total cost of the breach isn't enough to you know, when you have to pay out everything included, $1.6 million, cyber, your policy covers half or more of that, and your security budget would have been $3, $4, $5 million. Why do it? So is it reasonable to say, as long as you don't have one of those Ford Pinto memorandums sitting around, that, I mean, can you picture companies saying, "No, we're good. We don't have to worry about this thing."
No, because you have to behave reasonably in today's environment. People, we no longer have the right as companies to go through life on cybersecurity cruise control and pretend that it's not an issue. There's enough awareness. There's been enough, you know, news, publicity, reports to where everybody knows the risk now. They know they have to undertake an analysis of what their unique risk is, and they have to act reasonably in the face of that risk to secure their company. It doesn't mean they have to be secure, but secure enough for wherever they are. And any company that doesn't do that risks the litigation. And look, these lawsuits, the way they work, you have to understand the distinction between the consumer litigation and, like in many cases, the contractual litigation, like we see with the financial.
Right.
In Target, for example, you had the consumers who pursued their claims and got a small fraction of what they were asking for because they couldn't show their harm. But you had the financial institutions that sought in the beginning like $45 million because they had to pay to have new debit cards and credit cards issued for everybody. And so they brought their claims, and because they could show their harm, they settled for something like $44 million, almost exactly what they sought.
Yeah.
And so looking at a consumer class action case and saying that's indicative of even the litigation costs of a company is very, you know, short-sighted, because if you are in the supply chain with someone and you know, many times you're going to have indemnifications, you're going to have contractual obligations to protect data, to respond on behalf of the company, things like that. That's just basic lawsuits of paying for damages you caused, regardless of whether it's in the cyber arena or not.
Well, let's look at this from a financial perspective. So just running the numbers, you know, that I was able to find in the Wall Street Journal on Neiman Marcus's top line revenue, it was $1.7 billion. Last year, you know, the settlement was $1.6 million. So, you know, we're out four decimal places before we get to something that has a zero in it in terms of percentage. You know, it's 0.094%. You know, and when you look at where the investors, you know, who are really controlling these companies, you know, they're looking at this as, you know, strictly a bean counter game. And, you know, the management of these corporations is between a rock and a hard place, because if you don't perform financially, you're out. And, you know, Neiman Marcus is owned by Ares Management LLC and Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. And, you know, you'll be hard-pressed to find a company that is not playing strictly by the numbers, where you have a government pension board invested in them. And these pension boards have billions upon billions of dollars. And, you know, they can spread the risk around, and they can afford to risk a bankruptcy of one of their target investments to maximize the profit. And even then, you know, they might have put options or credit default swaps available. So to them, if it blows up, they don't lose any money, and they move on to the next target. So, you know, you can't necessarily fault the management for being cheap. Their hands may be tied, and, you know, I see this a lot in the work that I do.
That's gotta drive you nuts, Sean.
Yeah, you know, it does, and I don't know the answer to it. I just don't know the answer to how to deal with it.
Well, I suppose this will always this will keep going back to the courts.
Well, it will, but there's another case that people need to look at when they're looking at this analysis of saying, you know, what is it? I mean, really, when you boil it down, it's saying, what does a data breach really cost a company? And look at the Yahoo Verizon deal. That cost Yahoo or Yahoo's stockholders, shareholders, $500 million roughly, $500 million in that deal. And Yahoo then, under the deal, retained most of the liability for certain, you know, lawsuits and things, and split the liability or responsibility of it with Verizon on some of the other. That is a real cognizable harm originating from a breach that cost real money that people are going to be out of. So, you know, I know everyone loves to say, yeah, but, you know, the CEO only gets $23 million now or something like that. And that's true, but you can't just look at the CEO. I mean, you know, she's a lady who called her security team the paranoids. But you know, that case shows the real financial harm that can come about because of lack of security. So I think there's a real issue, especially companies who are considering mergers, acquisitions, things of that down the road.
That's a fairly good assessment. Well, guys, we are at the hour mark, and as I expected, we ran a little bit long, but hopefully, folks, you're still listening along. This has definitely been the right kind of crew to talk this through. Sean, thanks for riding along here.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I enjoyed it as always. Thank you for having me.
John, thanks for dropping by the office to record this.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to have you back in the ATL.
Yeah, and I'm being welcomed by extreme severe weather. Welcome to it's like the Midwest followed me down, but that's all right. At least it's not raining and cold and snowing, sleeting. So I'll leave that behind. Cool, folks. Thanks for listening. This has been another newscast from the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. And as always, you can catch us on Twitter, hashtag DTSR. Sean E. Tuma over on Twitter. And John, what's your Twitter handle?
Dearest Leader.
Oh, boy. The comedy with you never ends. You are the original APT. All right. Thanks a lot, folks. Thanks for listening. We will catch you on next week on another time, another place, on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. See you later. Ciao. Bye.
You've been listening to Down the Rabbit Hole Enterprise Security News. Give us feedback on our website, podcast.whiterabbit.net. That's whonetrabbit.net. Or on Twitter at White Rabbit, whonetrabbit. Till next time, on behalf of our co-hosts James Jardine, Michael Santarcangelo,
and the White Rabbit, Rafael Loos. Thanks for listening.